Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And I'm Simone Tagliapietro.
Climate change is becoming a central policy for most countries in the world. This is also the case of China. However, as the largest emitter in the world, China's actions go beyond its borders. And today, we will have a reflection on the topic, in particular, ahead of the forthcoming COP26. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhongua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining the conversation today is Michael Maiden, who is the director of the China Energy Program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Joseph. Thank you for having me.
With less than 2 months to go before the opening of the major COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, China increasingly is at the center of global climate policy attention. The country has indeed missed the July 31st deadline set by the United Nations to submit the new emissions reduction pledges, known as Nationally Determined Contribution, NDCs, sparkling doubts about the level of its future contribution to the Paris Agreement. On the other hand, in September 2020, China announced its intentions to peak carbon emissions by 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality by 2060. The neutrality goal, in particular, was a breakthrough for global climate ambitions, a net zero target from the world's largest emitter, responsible for around one quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions. So, Michael, how do you see China standing on this?
And of course, it was a hugely momentous announcement in September, the 2030, perhaps less so because it's a slightly more ambitious tweak to China's existing NDCs. But the 2060 carbon neutrality goal is hugely significant, even just for global momentum, right? We're only starting to get the details. Xie Zhenhua, chief negotiator, recently said that this would include CO2 emissions, but also methane and HFC. So that was, you know, already a good level of detail. But of course, China has failed to issue its NDCs by sort of the end of July when other countries did. So I think China is slightly ambiguous here that it is willing to do a lot, especially since it serves a lot of domestic interests. And it does want to take a leading diplomatic role in framing the discussion, but also I think it is still reluctant to being held publicly accountable for more detailed goals. I think it still stands by the common but differentiated responsibility. So it's still arguing that developing countries should not be held to the same standards as developed countries. So even though it's stepping into the limelight, I think it's still taking a slightly more, ambivalent approach on how proactive to be internationally.
Thank you, Michael. I'm sure that both Alicia and Simone have some additional thoughts and follow-up reflections on what you just said.
Yeah, if I may start, indeed, I completely agree with what has been said. I think that the world was really happy to see China announcing these 2030 and 2060 climate targets. But then, of course, people want to see the detail about how China intends to deliver on these targets. And many of the observers expected the 14th five-year plan of China to provide such a plan, given the strategic importance of the document. Now, we know that this document was ultimately pretty weak on the climate side, and now the idea is that the ball is in the hands of ministries, of local governments, to come up with their own plans at the provincial level, but both at the provincial level and in individual ministries to provide a detailed plans to decarbonization. But this is, of course, something that is risky, because if the general framework, political framework, doesn't provide the right indications about where to go, maybe it's not trivial to expect the local authorities and the ministries to have the power to do that. So I think the position of China really remains ambiguous with this regard, and the presentation of China and the sea will be extremely important to understand better how the country really wants to achieve its decarbonization pledges and how serious it is about achieving these decarbonization pledges, starting, if I may, with the issue of coal, which certainly represents a key issue at the table here.
Thank you, Simone, and we are going to get to the issue of coal in a second, but I would like to hear Alicia if she has something to add to this first reflection on China's standing on the topic.
Thank you, Giuseppe, and thank you, Michele. It's been very, very interesting. I really want to echo Simone's point on the fact that there seems to be more than one objective. Put it this way. I mean, the first objective is to make sure that China is on board internationally on this humongously important goal, which is climate change and how to address it. But at the other end, China does have a lot of other issues to deal with, to start basically managing growth through a pandemic. And I think while there probably was a plan, in my opinion, or kind of the embryo of a plan, that plan might have been, the details of the plan might have been shelved or at least rearranged. And I think one way for me to draw that conclusion is that you see, even today, you know, really a lot of push on stabilizing coal production in the northern provinces. So, you know, it's like employment, income distribution, because at the end of the day, the northern provinces are suffering more than the others from aging and, you know, the kind of the wrong industrial specialization. I think China, in the light of this new theme of better income distribution, can't really possibly let it go. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, climate change is important, but there's many things happening in China that now that seem to be more urgent. And I think that might be behind the delay in giving more detail on how to achieve that 2060 carbon neutrality target.
Mikkel, you wanted to add something.
Yes, please, if I may come in. I mean, I agree that there are lots of different policy priorities within China that are delaying and seem to be sending very mixed messages, both within the country and internationally, about China's commitment. I do think that China is ambitious and committed, even though the 14th five-year plan was relatively weak. I think we have to bear in mind that the announcement in September was surprising, that the 2030-2060 announcements, not just outside of China, but also within China. And the whole policy process really started in September. So ministries and industries have had to adapt to this change of direction that was quite fundamental, I think. And I think there's also what Simone was talking about, this issue of policy signals. The central government has to be prescriptive, but it also has to be flexible enough to allow provincial governments to meet these targets. And I think that's part of the challenge here of getting something that seems coherent from China. I don't think it will look coherent for a long time to come, but that doesn't mean that China isn't committed. And I think we also have to bear in mind, to me, the announcement came from a sense of urgency that isn't just about climate awareness. It is also very much an industrial question for China. The world is becoming much more carbon conscious with the EU, with the Fit for 55 and other plans. I think China realized, especially through the pandemic, with all these questions about supply chains, that it has to have more resilient supply chains, also from a carbon factoring, also from a carbon point of view. And therefore, I think there's also, interestingly, there will be some semantics. You know, the world or the West talks about sustainable development. China talks about a low carbon society. And I think there's a technical and industrial angle there that is significant, because that's where China is coming at this from. And so I think this will happen. And again, the ambition is huge, but there are long-term realities and short-term political needs that will make this a very messy process.
Thank you, Mikael. I actually, hearing the three of you speaking, it takes, you know, a first impression that it's quite hard at the moment to judge the direction, the steering course, because on one hand there is a situation on the ground and the pandemic and the recovery that is happening, and on the other hand there is like this broader ambitions, which seems to be to a certain extent quite genuine from what you are saying. But given the absence of those of the details on how to reach those targets, the 30-60 targets, I mean, one way to forecast in normal times would be to look at the facts on the ground. Now, I understand that there is a certain part of the facts on the ground that might be due to what Alicia just said, the pandemic and what has been going on in the past year and a half. But still, do some of the stuff that are going on can tell us at least something about what could be the direction or what is actually going on, so what is actually happening at the moment, you know, beyond the declarations and the ambitions. I don't know if Mikael, you do want to kick off this this reply to me, or if someone else wants.
I can start briefly. I think Alicia will probably have more of the kind of hard data. The facts on the ground look like a very brown recovery from COVID, right? It's been the government's tried and tested, rely on state-owned enterprises, state-owned funding to develop infrastructure. And yes, it's been perhaps infrastructure that will facilitate electric vehicles and new electricity grid lines. But so far, it's been very fossil fuel and emissions intensive. And really, it looks like China is on a very brown trajectory. Simona referred as well to more coal-fired power plants, because China's had power shortages and this issue of reliability has come to the forefront of the policy debate. And so I think when we look at the economy and at the economic recovery, it is very brown and kind of very fossil fuel heavy. I do think it is important to look at the declaratory level, because it starts from the top. And I think we've had consistent messaging and signaling from Xi Jinping himself. We've had, to me, this is extremely significant, Han Zheng, who is basically the leader who is in charge of the energy and environment portfolio, create a leading group for the 2030, for the 3060, for the dual carbon targets. That is sort of a steering committee, right, at the highest level, that will be in charge of implementation. I think these are extremely significant signals. There has been more discussion about green financing. The People's Bank of China has talked more about green bonds. They're nascent, they're small, but the messaging, I think, has to give the direction of travel before realities on the ground can change. We've had central inspection levels. We've had, and interestingly, I think we've had the NDRC, which is kind of the planning authority, take over a lot of power from the Ministry of Ecology and Environment. Those are not necessarily bad signals, but again, I do think that what we're seeing on the ground does not match the level of aspiration yet.
Simone, would you agree with the analysis?
Absolutely. I think I would entirely agree to what has just been said. And just to give you a figure, in 2020, China put 38 gigawatt of new coal-fired power capacity into operation, which equals the entire coal-fired power generation capacity currently installed in Germany. So while we see and we welcome this ambition for 2030 and 2060 by the government, we unfortunately still do not see concrete actions being undertaken, as Alicia said. Growth has certainly been the priority for China last year, and of course keeps being the priority this year. So it is very difficult in a way to understand how China can really readdress actions to embark into a sensible decarbonization pathway until coal, for example, continues to play such an important role in the energy mix. Let me remember that coal still represents 57% of China energy mix, and this is the most important item while discussing the country's decarbonization. And as we have recently also published a blog post on this with Alicia, you see subsidies that are keeping going into fossil fuels. In China, we have seen data around $12 billion each year go into fossil fuels, and namely into coal-fired power generation. So until the government addresses this issue, we cannot really consider the pledges made to be really serious.
And Alicia, on other fronts, like Michael mentioned sustainable finance or other aspects of the economy, let's say innovation or these kind of things, what we can observe at the moment? Is there a narrative that is coinciding with what we've been just discussing so far?
I want to thank you, Giuseppe. I want to make your question perhaps more general and link it to Michael's point on the industrial nature of the plan.
Exactly. That's what I mean by broadening up a bit,
Because I think it's a very good point. There's many reasons why, and of course, this is not the only reason why China may want to engage in climate change. I'm sure there are societal reasons, you know, nobody denies that. But the industrial part of it is very important. I think China realizes, and Simone and I wrote about this, that at the end of the day, this electrification of its industries, whether it's electric vehicles, whether, you know, it comes through an electricity grid that is basically coal driven. So, you know, at the end of the day, what we're saying here is that China is aware that its industrial model could come at a much higher cost if the world were to kind of realize it. Not that we don't, but we do not charge for it. It's kind of a, if you think about what has happened in the world, I mean, the world has been importing all of these goods produced by a type of energy that was subsidized, but that we now don't like. And at some point, this is going to, you know, burst in the face of somebody, and China doesn't want to be that face. So I think there's an increasing recognition that this needs to change before it's too late, before it becomes absolutely obvious. I mean, the embryo of that, of course, one could argue is Europe's carbon border adjustment tax, but I think it's a much more general issue. It could come from all kinds of initiatives. And China realizes that it needs to incorporate all of this in its industrial policy in whatever way possible, whether it's perhaps moving towards industries that are less heavy in terms of energy use, whether at the same time it implies reducing coal as Simone said, in the certainly in the electricity part, but generally in the energy basket, in all of these forms. But it's really an industrial policy issue. And I think this is why, in a way, China is reluctant somehow to be very detailed, because this is not a societal issue. This is an industrial policy issue. This is about competition globally. So in a way, they are stuck in that reality of trying to cooperate, but at the same time trying to save what could be a very bad outcome in the future for their own industry. And I think that explains a lot of what we are seeing.
So if we look at the fact that the special envoy on climate, they declared in July that they will soon present, before COP26, the this N+1 policy framework, and give more details on the implementation of those climate targets. What we should expect, I mean, also on the basis of what Alicia just said, of this overlap between climate policy and industrial policy, what should we expect in the next weeks or months from the Chinese side in terms of not too much how much details they will reveal, but what we could expect those elements that they will be announced would include?
And I think, we're going to have lots of statements and lots of issues of regulations coming out of China over the next weeks and months as part of the 14th five-year plan process. I do want to highlight, though, I think, in the West, we look at a plan and we say, there it is, the definitive document. That's the be-all and end-all. But in reality, I think these five-year plan processes, they have a life of their own, right? There's the initial document that comes out, and then there's ministerial and provincial, and it keeps getting adjusted and adapted, right? There are the binding targets that have to be met, but otherwise there are targets that keep getting adjusted up or down and are sometimes missed. So it is, again, it's the general direction of travel, but I don't think we should, obviously as analysts, it's really helpful to have these numbers and the targets and we can benchmark against those. But they are a general sense of direction. So when we get these new announcements, I think we need to bear that in mind. I think also going back to what Alicia was saying, that it's an industry rather than, and I agree, it is more of an industrial action plan. There is a climate emergency element to it, at least in the context of food security, because we've seen all these extreme weather events impact on China's energy food security. And in the context of a world that is decoupling and an external environment that is very hostile to China, at least in China's perception, these are really big problems. But if it is an industrial rather than a climate emergency, China has time. And also, we have to bear in mind that China still has a decade, or at least, there's a 2035 vision that views the Chinese economy doubling again. That means growth. It means growth in energy use and energy demand, even if it becomes more efficient. And even if the share of coal in electricity consumption and in the energy mix falls, the overall pie is still getting bigger. And so there's still room for more coal consumption, even though the ambition is for renewables to take a bigger share in the increments. But the pie is getting bigger, and so we have to bear that in mind as well. What we will see over the next few weeks, and it was interesting as well that there was a Politburo meeting at the end of July that said, we have to stop this campaign-style emissions reductions. Every province was issuing green targets and green plans and hydrogen plans, and then the Politburo comes out and says, stop, stop, we have to cool things down, which was a bit worrying. And this is where the 1+N policy comes in. I think what the government is trying to do is issue the framework policy, which is the one, and then N, which is the sectoral policies. But I think they really want to try and guide and direct this initiative, because some of the kind of overzealous implementation could sacrifice economic growth. Point is, we're going to see a lot of declarations and they're going to be very confusing, because we are going to see this issue of reliability, more coal-fired power plants, I think, but also much more renewables and much more emphasis on technology and innovation in order for China to get on a different growth path, both in terms of industrial, but also in terms of energy consumption and innovation. And so, again, I think we have to bear in mind that this is going to be a very iterative process and that there is still a huge amount of debate, even for the 2030 peaking targets. China hasn't given an absolute level of emissions. It can keep growing and peak emissions at a very high level and only then start to decrease emissions. There is even a debate about that right now. And I think what we're going to hear is some of the reflection of those debates coming out.
Yeah, of course, I would very much agree that for China, like for any other countries, but in China, this issue is particularly difficult, is the issue of decoupling. No, how can the country basically decouple its economic growth from a rise in greenhouse gas emissions, which we have traditionally seen in the world, not only in China, of course. So decoupling becomes the key challenge for governments now moving forward. And of course, the energy transition is the main answer to this need to decouple economic growth and greenhouse gas emissions. I think the 1+N policy framework that was announced by the China Special Envoy on Climate Change in July will be an important document indeed to orient where really the country will intend to go over the next months. And in my view, certainly the degree of solidity of this initiative will be very telling about the trustworthiness of China NDC and overall climate action. So I would really expect observers to look at this general policy document with a great degree of interest to really understand what we can expect from the country as we move forward.
Thank you, Simone. I don't know if Alicia and Michal agree with that.
I mean, I agree observers are going to look at these documents, but I think the nature of the policymaking and again, the debate and uncertainty about the specifics, right? The direction of travel is set. How to get there is still an open question. And so I think much like with the 14th five-year plan, a lot of external observers were waiting for very clear indications, were disappointed. I think, again, the upcoming messages, yes, there is going to be the overall plan. It might still be thin on details, because it's also interesting that when this was launched, the government sort of said to every province, you have to give us your kind of energy balance sheet and tell us how you're going to peak emissions and by when. So there's like a mini Paris process going on within China, where each province has to, you know, come up with some solutions. And again, that could be, and this is kind of a classic bargaining process within Chinese ministries and provinces that have different policy priorities as well, right? They need social stability, they need growth. Some provinces like Guangdong can be very much ahead of the curve in terms of their energy policy and moving towards renewables, whereas others, coal-heavy provinces such as Inner Mongolia or Shaanxi, have a coal problem to deal with. And so again, the outlook is going to be very, very different. And when we look at that overarching number one paper, it is again going to reiterate that the direction of travel, but it could still be quite weak on details because of all these challenges and because of the government needs to leave room for the provinces to implement. And so I'm not sure that we are going to get all the answers that we would like to from these documents. It would be great to have a very clear and definitive view. It would be great to have Xi Jinping at COP26 giving a definitive answer. I still think that these are kind of domestically driven policies and priorities, and the international community is something of an afterthought. So even if we're left a little bit unsatisfied, I think China can live with that, and we will have a harder time sort of dealing with it.
Yeah, of course. And I think that's very clear. And an additional thing is that even when a policy is announced or even implemented, that's again often just the start of a long journey. You know, we have seen that with the emission trading system that was recently launched at the national level. Of course, a very important step for the climate policy of China, but we are currently seeing that the system is far from delivering on on what is really required for the decarbonization process. Again, even in specific policies, there is a long way also internally and internal struggles, I would say, to fix in order to then get these policies to the right level of action that is really needed to then contribute to the country's decarbonization process.
One thing that was very interesting, Michal, when you discussed before the diversity of within China itself, I think that for us observers from an outside perspective, from Europe, from the United States, and the rest of the world, sometimes we tend to forget how complex the geography and diverse the needs also when it comes to the economic development are changing within China itself. One thing, Michal, that surprised me, but not really, but that is interesting, especially for our listeners who are from an outside perspective, not necessarily aware of the diversity within China itself. When you say, you know, the difference between Inner Mongolia and another region where maybe, you know, they are very relying on a coal-intensive economy. This reminds me almost the kind of debates we are having at the European Union level when we have a debate about the implementation of the European Green Deal, where we have the famous Polish miners, you know, who definitely have a certain you know, need, and when we discuss about the just transition fund within the EU in order to tackle also, you know, the effects, the negative effects that could come up, the social effects that come up from the transition. So that's very, very interesting. And also the fact of framing the debate within China, I think it's a very fresh eye for our listeners approaching the debate which we are going to have at international level over the COP26. Nevertheless, and going towards also the end of this discussion, I would like to, you know, go more a bit on the global dimension and consequences of all this. You know, obviously the climate crisis goes beyond the borders of China, and you know, Alicia mentioned several times that there is definitely a global economics and competitiveness aspects to it, and definitely there is a geopolitical aspect to all what we are discussing over there. Alicia, you mentioned before the carbon border adjustment mechanism as an example of the readiness or not readiness. I mean, that's one of the questions I would like to hear from you, of China to accept cooperation mechanisms which are not as voluntary as the targets from COP26 and the Paris Agreement and so on. So perhaps starting from that, and I ask you, Alicia, to kick off, and then I would like to hear from Miguel and Simone what they think about it. How does China's climate policy then resonate within the global landscape?
Thank you, Giuseppe. I want to link this question to what Michael said before about China following its own path. Yeah. And basically, China really wanting to avoid a climate change catastrophe. Nobody denies this, but I want to play a little bit the devil's advocate. By simple observation of when the targets were announced, when the ETS was established, if you look at those specific dates, you realize that the 2060 carbon neutrality announcement was made, at the UN right before, right at the end of the negotiations with the European Union for the Comprehensive Investment Agreement, coincidentally. Then the ETS was launched basically when the EU was about to launch the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. I'm not saying the EU is so important, don't take me wrong, but what I'm saying is that even if China has its own targets and undeniably important targets, it also has tactical targets, yeah, as to how to use those targets. And to me, this is very clear. So this brings me to the fact that there's some defensive, or so I read it. Of course, I don't know whether this is indeed the case, but my reading of all of these targets is that they are defensive, meaning that they are trying also, and not only, of course, to avoid a more coercive approach to climate change. So I don't know whether you agree with this, but this is my sense of what I'm seeing. Yeah. So the ETS market that Simone mentioned started with some liquidity the first day, and the price was decent, something like low, but decent. Nothing since. I mean, it's like you create something, you tick the box, but are you really going to make it work? And I'm not saying it will never work. but it might work again tactically when needed. And maybe China has many other means to achieve that wonderful target, but that's something we'll probably not know about for a long time. So there's like two narratives here I sense, and I'd like to hear your view about this.
Absolutely. I think that's a fantastic observation. I think the timing was critical. I mean, obviously, China issued the 30-60 targets a week after a meeting with the EU. Of course, the EU would have wanted to issue the targets jointly. China went alone. It was also before the Biden, well, before the US presidential elections and the results, but preempting a potential where Biden would get elected and the US would be back in the fray. And I think China signaled that it was going it alone. And then at the same time, reserving that ambiguity of not giving too much detail. But China, I think, clearly taking on, I think, as we said at the beginning, an ambiguous global diplomatic leadership role. I think certainly there is a tactical element of fending off sort of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, saying, hang on, we have our own ETS, and maybe that could link up. And we are working towards something that is more compatible with what the EU would like to see. I think also on the ETS, obviously, this is something that has been in the making for, well, for almost a decade, and it will take time for it to even start to increase the cost of carbon for Chinese industries. And this is, you know, we can get into an hour-long discussion about the role of the state versus the market in China and how you achieve effective and efficient outcomes. I don't think the ETS is the key element, as Alicia was saying, to achieving China's carbon neutrality, but it's another mechanism that China is trying to perfect. And this is, again, a theme that came out from our entire discussion, time, right? Things take a long time in China because it's big and it's complicated. So I think that there is a tactical element. And I think China is finding its feet diplomatically. We've seen China become more active, more assertive, even diplomatically, globally. I think climate change is an area where it is willing to take this kind of role, because it wants to shape the direction of both carbon border adjustment mechanisms and various tariffs. Because I think I get the sense that China also feels that it can shape some of the global technical standards. It wants to contribute to the biodiversity discussions. So it is willing to take a leadership role, but I think, and just with maybe a clear recognition that that was the general direction, right? The EU is ambitious, that a Biden administration would be back. So it is hugely significant, and it's fantastic for global climate policies that everybody is on the same page at last. You know, then we will get into the minutiae of the discussions. And I think what China wants from COP26 specifically is some kind of discussion about carbon border adjustment mechanisms and tariffs. It wants to be part of the discussion on the financials of how much developed countries will put aside for developing countries. And China is still very ambiguous on whether it's a developed or developing economy here. But obviously, it wants to be the leader of the developing world still. And this issue of technology and innovation and collaboration, I think this is what it does want from international fora. But it's still going to be a very mixed bag, I think, for China in the way it positions itself.
Well, in my view, timing is critical here. As we have heard, and I agree, China has its own timing on decarbonization because it's big, it's complicated. But I think as the IPCC report that was released right before the summer made clear, we don't have time anymore. So the world cannot wait for China, and global warming certainly will not wait for China. And climate science is clear. The next 10 years are the crucial ones to put in place the action required to really readdress the climate crisis. And the countries that are willing to play their part, like the European Union, but also most recently the United States, will, in my view, act accordingly. And being aware that the EU represents 8% of global emissions, the United States 13% of global emissions, and China 26% of global emissions, these countries will certainly put in place all the possible mechanisms to, let's say, incentivize other countries out there, China first, to do their job. So I understand that China has been very good so far in coming up with the right announcement at the right moment to sort of appease other countries in this discussion, but sooner or later, this will be evaluated by facts. So when the carbon border adjustment measures of the European Union will be in place and progressively, I hope quickly, expanded to all imports, either the price of the ETS in China will be significant, or basically the Chinese goods will be subjected heavily to carbon border adjustment measures. So at a certain point, reality will come to you. So I think we have 10 years in front of us, during which the European Union, possibly the United States, will be crafting these measures, like carbon border adjustment, and testing them with limited scope for the beginning, etc. But then the real game starts in 2030, because between 2030 and 2050 is when we really need to achieve the deep emission cuts required to get to net zero. At that point, China must be ready as well. If China doesn't seize these 10 years ahead of us to put in place the needed policies to deliver on its own targets, then frictions, in my view, will inevitably emerge, and the trade will be, of course, at the center of these frictions. And given the fact that the European Union and the United States represent the most important markets for the Chinese exports, these will be significant macroeconomically for the country. So I think the Chinese leadership clearly knows this very well, of course. And let's see whether they will, over the next years, be able to really deliver on this important issue.
Thank you, Simone, for those words that somehow also wrap it up in looking ahead to the challenges that we are going to have, not only in the discussion with China, but in general, as you say, as this is a global problem and an urgent problem. So because we are really short now on time towards the end of our episode, I would just like to ask Michael and Alisa if you have anything to add to this last reflection from Simone, and then we are going to wrap it up.
I mean, I think it's very hard to add to those very wise and important words, and certainly not to end on a pessimistic note. My concern is that even though the trend is clear and the need for action is clear, the politics and geopolitics are not working in our favor. My concern is that we add cost and we lose time by not being able to coordinate and integrate on, you know, technology scaling up, on collaborative policies. I do hope that in the next, well, less than 10 years, cooler heads prevail, or at least the rationale for collaboration and working together towards climate change does become more deeply entrenched, both in the US or in the US, EU and China. And that will be a path forward, because the way things stand right now, my concern is that we're not on a good trajectory, despite the urgency and of the crisis.
Alicia?
I'm going to end with a question for Michael, maybe no time to answer, but at least I leave it there. How come it be that a country that produces 80% of solar panels, of the global share, that has the 80% of the global share of solar panels, can still keep 70% of electricity production with coal? I just don't understand it. And because I don't understand that question, I also, by the way, at the cheapest cost possible, meaning for the solar panel. So because I don't understand that question, I also don't understand the plan. Because the plant should be there already, because they have the ability to produce those solar panels, and increasingly, of course, also on other technologies. We just wrote about hydrogen. I mean, Simone and I, it seems like it's feasible. So why isn't it happening? That's my question, really.
mean, I think we're going to have to schedule another podcast just to discuss those.
Indeed, indeed.
But I think the short answer is scale. Even though China produces a lot of the, first of all, we're talking about China has what, 200 gigawatts roughly of installed solar versus 1,100 gigawatts of coal. So it's not just adding to incremental supplies, but it's replacing existing supplies. We then get back to, I think the harder issue for China is not adding supplies, but it is taking away, it's creating losers, right? It's phasing out coal, and it is integrating a system that can efficiently dispatch and use the electricity that is available. And that's where the system is skewed in favor of coal still, where reliability plays in favor of coal, employment, growth. And that's where I do think that the signals from the top matter, because that's when the change starts to happen. I agree with you. I think China can add wind, renewable, hydrogen. I'm not so sure it can innovate without input from the rest of the world. It can certainly add supplies, but at what point does it start to create losers, such as the coal industry and the fossil fuel industry? And how can it better manage demand side? So using market or other tools to regulate the demand side of the equation, I think that's the challenge for China. Not one that cannot be overcome, but that is kind of where the challenges lie.
Sorry, Michael, I know we are short of time, but I mean, actually, Giuseppe can cut this thing before my question, which he will probably do. So, and
I will probably not do, because this is a super interesting part of the conversation.
I just want to add to that, I mean, as an economist, okay, it's not really about losers. It's that you made the losers the winners because you're subsidizing coal. I mean, you're basically subsidizing coal more than any other renewable. And beyond that, you're also selling, you know, your solar panels everywhere else, frankly speaking, even dumping the prices everywhere else. Why you should keep them home? I mean, so the whole thing to me sounds like, I'm sorry, I'm not ready. As simple as that, because I'm not ready to take the consequences, which are social, economic, and political. It's not about climate. And that's why I feel like it can't be specific, because they've not made up their minds by mere fact of observing what's happening. Just as simple as that. I'm not even reading documents, because when I observe what I just said, gosh, it's just too complex. It's too expensive politically. That's my reading, my humble reading of what I see there out there.
And if I may, because we need to close the conversation at some point, I think that at The Sound of Economics, we are going to keep discussing the issue, because of course, as we said before, this is like a centerpiece of both the climate policy at the global level, but also of industrial policy at Chinese level. Geopolitics is involved, and much more is involved, which we haven't even touched in this conversation today. We just scratched the surface of something that is so important and so key. So I promise the listeners that we are going to keep discussing this in the frame of our focus on China. I would like to once again do a little bit of an advertisement and invite you to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, which tackles some of those issues every month. And the link is in the show notes, so you can just click over there and subscribe. I would like to thank so much Michael, Alicia, and Simone for this wonderful conversation today. And I would like to thank all our listeners. And as usual, we are going to be tuned in very soon again. So until next time, bye-bye.